This is Monocle on Design, our weekly look at the best in architecture, craft, furniture and fashion. I'm Nick Manise. On today's show, we're travelling across Europe. First, we'll head to Restelo, Lisbon's picturesque hillside neighbourhood, to explore its beautiful architecture. Then, it's off to Bolzano to meet Plank, the iconic Italian furniture brand with a forward-thinking approach. And, finally, we'll hear about the Norwegian concept of Dugnad and how one architecture practice is applying it to the built environment. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24. Do stay tuned. We begin today's show with a trip to Lisbon. Here, the 20th century hillside neighbourhood of Restelo is hemmed in by the enormous Monsanto Park, the River Tragus, and the district of Belém. It's a prime position that, over the past 90 years, has helped to entrench it as one of the Portuguese capital's most desirable and livable enclaves. To find out how and why this neighbourhood came to be, I set out on a tour. Far from being a happy accident, the neighbourhood of Restelo developed as part of a grand plan by the Portuguese government, who sent a young, unknown architect, João Guilherme Faria de Costa, to Paris to study the emerging discipline of urban planning. Upon his return from France, and drawing on the principles of the Garden City movement, Faria de Costa laid out this new suburb with a vision of it hosting villas with grand gardens in a network of verdant public spaces. It was an ambition best captured in the first stage of his plan, developed from 1938 to 1948. And it's this initial phase that I visited with Patricia Bento de Alameda, an architect and researcher at the University Institute of Lisbon. Her grandfather, Joaquim, designed some 50 houses in the area, making her the perfect driver for a tour of the neighbourhood.
At the beginning, they invest in an urban planner that we didn't have. Mm. So Duarte Pacheco said, I need an urban planner, but I don't have. So go to Paris, study there, and then come to Lisbon and do what you learned before. And this idea allowed to call for people that wanted to live in this area because they said, well, you have the river there, you have the park on the top, you will have your garden. This is a really nice place to live. You have a self-sufficiency there, but that didn't happen. Everyone wanted to come here, and they had money enough to ask for an architect to build them houses.
As Patricia explains, the concept sold itself. By the late 1940s, lots in Restelo were going under the hammer at highly competitive auctions that attracted those who had visionary ideas about how they wanted to live. As a result, architects working in the neighbourhood in the 1950s were given free rein to imbue the latest ideas into their structures. Homes were built to modernist ideals, horizontal lines, flat roofs and a clean aesthetic that embedded houses into the landscape. Portuguese crafts were incorporated into many projects too. A perfect example is Praça de Goa 6 by Patricia's grandfather and his business partner, Victor Pella. Built for a naval officer, the home has a nautical theme with a gangway-style entry and tiles that are hand-painted with a wavy blue pattern.
Those tiles were designed by the two architects. This architect has some of others from the same years. They work together with the artists. They worked together with sculptors and painters, and they did what we call a unique project, you know? They worked together since the beginning.
So it was like a cohesive effort between the architects and the artists, and they would make sculptures and...
Yeah, and sometimes they invited some quite famous artists to work with them, but other times they did it themselves. This team of architects, they were also artists, so in this house, Praça de Goa house, they did the tiles for the facade.
So they designed them themselves?
They designed them themselves for this house.
I love that.
And you have other houses where that happened too. And you can see the modernity of this project, but also because they create with this owner, with the first owner of this house, they create a friendship.
Between the owner and the architect?
Yeah. the owner told to the architects what he wanted, but he gave a little bit of freedom to express themselves, and they gave also money to invite an artist to work with them.
Today, the building, like so many of the grand homes in the area, has been repurposed. Prasatagoa 6 is now a school, while other grand houses have become embassies. And though these former homes are significant, the neighbourhood also houses some important modernist commercial buildings. Of note is Rua das Lojas, the first open-air shopping mall in Portugal, which features four buildings on a lush garden-lined street. Opened in 1954, it formed one of the latter phases of the Restelo development, where smaller compact homes, designed by Faria da Costa himself, were the dominant built form. The new mall served this population, something it still manages to do today, with its boutiques, cafes and pastry shops.
Well, Faria da Costa designed the street, designed the urban arrangement. And he designed the street and he defined, I want a commercial place here. And then João Ramalho, that was the architect, had just the idea, but he was a modern architect, influenced by the modern architects from the world, not especially from the Brazilian modernism.
You can see, like Niemeyer and...
You can see here the influences. And he created this separation, you know, like...
So it's like the street on the ground plane and then the buildings are lifted up, separated by gardens.
Separated by this small part of gardens. This is really fresh on summer because of the trees, that the leaves go down, and then you have a nice place in winter also because there the sun goes to the exterior.
So the sun still reaches through the storefronts.
This works. This really works. And he also worked with an artist to design, that is Querubim Lapa. That was a
that works ceramicist.
Ceramicist that did the tiles.
Okay, so these little custom tile designs with like those circles and arches on them.
Do you see the tiles, the green and red tiles?
Yeah.
They mark the entrance of the buildings because you have apartments on the first floor. This is commercial, like street commercial in houses on the top.
And it's quite nice because so like the patio areas in front are like set underneath almost that first floor with like the pillars, and so you get sun in winter sitting there,
you have,
and shade in summer,
yes, you have that,
and looking over a garden and separated from the cars.
You can,
it's pretty good.
You can be there with kids, that is not dangerous, you know. The idea of a commercial street was supposed to exist in other places of Restelo. We don't know if the other commercial areas were supposed to be like this in terms of architecture, but in terms of urban idea, was the same. This was supposed to give day life to Restelo, to the houses.
And while it has evolved and changed over time, it's perhaps less self-sufficient than Faria da Costa envisioned, Restelo is a reminder of what a good suburb could and should be. It's a place where an urban plan complements the rhythm of the landscape it sits in, and whose residents are willing to commission architects to design bold, breathtaking homes and gardens as well. For Monocle, in Restelo, I'm Nick Manise.
Join Marco Sippi for the menu, bringing you Monocle 24's recipe for the best in drinking and dining. We make entertaining a doddle.
It's incredibly easy to make.
With expert opinions.
You can use fish fillets, which you grill in the oven or pan fry.
A bit of seasoning.
Lots of lime, a lot of cracked pepper, and a bit of good olive oil.
And plenty of spice.
And then you cook it in caraway and seven spice.
As well as something sweet.
Then you take a big pot of mascarpone and spoon it into your egg yolk.
And maybe even a little bit nuts.
You take it out, you top it with some pine nuts, and you're good to go.
It's a recipe that's guaranteed to impress.
It's slightly controversial, but it's the one thing that has surprised the most people when they eat it.
Premiering live on Monocle 24 every Friday at 20:00 London time, midday in Los Angeles, or downloadable wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, we're off to South Tyrol. Here, in the Italian Alps, you'll find family-run heritage furniture brand Planck. Thanks to its long-time collaboration with German designer Konstantin Gerchich, the company has moved away from traditional timber chairs to models with new, cutting-edge materials. Of note is its Mito chair, a stackable cantilever seat which won Italy's famed Compasso d'Oro prize. We caught up with the brand's CEO, Michael Planck, to talk about his company's transformation.
Planck is a family business from South Tyrol, and we have been in business since 1893, mainly doing interior design fittings. My grandfather was a cabinet maker. He did several types of interiors, like kitchens, living rooms. And in the 50s, he received an order in Val Gardena for a hotel, to fit out a hotel, and he needed to do also around 150 chairs. For example, this is typically, you can see in this catalogue, the typical chair which developed out of this type of project. Actually, after this project, my grandfather then focused only on chairs. The style of the chair, it's called Bauernstuhl in German. And in Switzerland, it's called Stabelle. And it's a typical chair made completely of solid wood. And these chairs you can find in all the Alpine areas, like here in South Tyrol, in Austria, south of Germany, Switzerland. If you go to places and you find this traditional Bauernstuhl, if you switch it over, you probably will see our brand on it. My grandfather used to work also with architects, local architects, which designed a shape, and my grandfather produced them. And then my father, which was a wood engineer, he studied in Rosenheim, he brought the manufacturing on an industrial basis. End of the 80s, the type of style of product changed. The really traditional style was transformed by a more classic one. And that area was not the typically Planck area because it was not original. In the beginning of the 90s, my father started going around design fairs, and he understood that we need to be more contemporary. So end of the 90s, I came back from my studies from industrial design, and my father asked me to help him transform the company. I was working in a studio in Milano, and we said, yes, let's change the company radically. We said, let's do each year one product. We met Konstantin Gricic in 2003, came to our company, and we met, and I think it immediately was a good chemistry. And we started giving him a briefing, and after 2 years, we came out with the Murastool, which is was the first project with Konstantin. Both the company and also Konstantin were changing, or he was an emerging designer, young designer. And we liked his approach about technology. He's really technological also. We presented the Murastool as a prototype on the Cologne Fair in 2005, and it was an immediate success. People in the first time didn't understand what is this. Is this comfortable? Because it's a really different looking piece, but it's highly ergonomical. You know, if you look at the stool, you see the triangular shapes in the front. They are there to depress the feet, because when you sit on a round stool, normally you feel the edges. And on this stool, you don't feel anything. You know, it's a tool. I always say it's a tool. The Mito chair was our third product with Konstantin. Actually, Konstantin came to us because he was approached from the German chemical company BASF to do project to use a technical plastic or they produce. And he came up with the idea to do a chair. Constantine chose the cantilever chair. Cantilever chair is a chair on 2 feet, and it's the most difficult type of chair to bring into plastic. It has a grid on the back and on the seat, therefore it's really easy or light. There is a handle on the back side, also on the front, under the seat. It's again one of the design elements of Constantine, that he always is really functional, you know, he always tries to bring in also the functionality. The nice thing on this product is that, for example, if you put it on the grass, it don't sink into the grass, therefore it's the perfect chair for the outdoor. We are a hybrid brand. We don't typically build a chair for conference, but for example the Monza armchair, which is one of the most successful products, I use it in my living room, but it's also used in a church or in elderly houses or for example in hotels. We come from the more contract business historically also, so that was also our development. So we were not the typical brand for the domestic market always. So this was a natural development. But the most important thing is that the product is built for the contract market, but the expression and the feeling, also the emotion, is also for the living, you know, it's also for the residential market.
That was Michael Plank in conversation with Monocle's Ivan Cavallo. We'll be right back and headed to Norway straight after this.
The Foreign Desk is Monocle 24's weekly global affairs program. We tackle the world's biggest news stories, as well as those left untold.
If actually you speak to the ordinary people, their aspirations is for a unified country, whether you talk to business people, to school teachers, to market traders, and so on and so forth, across the board, is they want to see their country recreated as it was, only this time as a democratic, accountable system.
Our expert guests offer in-depth analysis and first-hand experience.
One of the Ebola treatment centres I went to had been burned down by a community that were very resentful and frightened of Ebola, and they still have a bunker in the middle. They've dug a big, deep bunker where they can hide if people come and shoot at them.
The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller, is available every Saturday from midday London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Finally on today's show, we turn our attention to the Norwegian concept of dugnad. The centuries-old cultural concept encourages participation to reach communal goals. And it's an ethos that Oslo-based studio Mad Architecture applies to its projects, so much so that it has opened a new exhibition on the topic at Berlin's 80s Architecture Forum. To find out more, Monocle's Charlie Fillmore-Court sat down with Jonny Klock, a partner at the firm, to discuss the concept and its relationship to the built environment. Jonny began by explaining what dugnad is and why it matters.
Dugnad is a term that's used throughout Norway for everything from small collaborations to big movements within the people. So it stems back actually from the 14th century, from when rural communities came together to build projects. And everyone sort of participated at their own ability towards a common goal. So it's just gathering people to try to do something together. They participate with the best of their own ability or their own skill set. For us, it's all about a mindset where people come together and share their knowledge and try to improve, in this case, the world. It's a big word, but we chose this name and this topic for our exhibition because we see that the building industry have been going the wrong way. We're a major factor in the pollution of the world and the climate crisis. We wanted to share 4 of our most sustainable projects, or 4 projects that we work with sustainability in different ways, to be able to sort of inspire and engage people towards building and thinking more sustainable and thus contributing to the dugnad.
Obviously, it is quite a wide-ranging term. It can be applied in many different instances, but Is it often applied to the built environment, or is that quite a new concept?
It's a new concept when you think about it in sort of more building projects. But like in Norway, if you live in a city dwelling, there's a common courtyard. A very common way to fix your lawn and courtyard is to have a dugnad, so that someone will rake leaves and someone will make some food. And it's been used very physically. And also sort of during the COVID-19 situation now, the term dugnad has been used for everyone participating at their own best, staying at home or following the governmental recommendations. So it's been, it's all about contributing. So it's been used for almost everything.
And how does MAD integrate, obviously as an architect practice, how does MAD integrate dugnad into its approach?
Through sharing, because architecture is a competitive field. Sometimes you have these big business secrets. How do you do this? How do you work with this topic? Our doors are always open and our ideas are always open to share to others. And that's how we sort of integrate it into our own practice, that we share with other people, also our competitors. We also try to integrate this positive mindset where we work within our company towards a common goal, that everyone works together. We have a very flat hierarchy, so trying to have everyone, like, it's always the best ideas that win in our office. So if it's an intern, if it's a partner or a founder or whoever comes up with a good idea for a project, that's what we follow. So we do this always throughout our projects as well. So if you see our portfolio of projects, they would all look completely different, because sort of the power is always in the project and in the solution.
Within the company, is that applied to the different kind of disciplines? Obviously, MAD has quite a wide range. It's got, you know, product design, interiors, landscapes. Is information and knowledge shared between those as well?
Yeah. So we try to share that as best of the ability. So it's like, for some projects, we are both architects and landscape and interior. This depends on project from project. Sometimes we work with other interior architects or landscape, so we mix that up. But for instance, recently we did a competition, and instead of having it as a sole architecture competition, we sat down to architects and to interior architects instead for the competition. So we try to mix up and try to sort of take advantage of the knowledge people have. And also, since we're situated in different towns and cities in Norway, and we work all over Norway and some abroad, we try to always mix up the teams with knowledge. So we try to do this throughout the projects.
And as an organization with, you have bases across multiple cities in Norway, do you think that that helps? I mean, obviously, in many instances, big businesses have their base in the capital, and that can bring about with it a bit of a capital-centric kind of outlook on things. Do you think this geographical diversity of the company helps you in the long run to have a diverse set of views and maybe a diverse approach to projects?
Yeah, I think so, because it's like when I started at MAD, we were only in Oslo. We were doing projects outside of Oslo, but then we saw the value in having the different towns. So then we set up one in the second largest town in Norway, and then later on. So over the last 7 years, so they've been established over the years. And we see that this local presence really has its own value, because in a way we get closer to the client and to the people that where we work. So we get more detailed knowledge about the sites and the places we're working. And also, since we're very focused on having the projects live by themselves, we see that since it's not a centric, everything is not part of the Oslo office, for instance, or Bergen, then we see that the projects that are created are quite diverse. So it gives us a much broader range in architecture, and they look quite different and act quite different. And then the only rules we have is that we're trying to make more sustainable projects, and that the projects should have this X factor or give something back to the community or to the town and the city that it's in. So it has to have this connection to the place and context. Apart from that, it could look in a multitude of ways.
Mm. And do you think that, you know, not just in Norway, but all over the globe, do you think that architects appreciate the benefits of collaboration? And do you think that's something that maybe architects could do more of? in many cases, obviously, the people who are living in the buildings might not be architecturally trained. They might not even be design minded. How do you kind of integrate them into the process?
Yeah, I think this collaboration is sort of the new architectural role. Of course, I haven't been an architect for a century, so I can't just say what they did in 1910. But to me, like how I would perceive it is that the architect's role has changed over the years. So you had, it used to be a very sort of, the architect said this and the architect was known by its name, not by a company's name. And the architect's saying is the rule. But we see that throughout every kind of projects, there are more and more specialists, more and more consultants, more and more things to say. So the architect's role is a mix between sort of knowing science, knowing social science, and also holding the aesthetics as a part of it. And I think the role of an architect is to be more pragmatic and to be able to sort of grasp as many of these flexible things in, because we integrate all of these things in our practices. And very often we work with everything from the real estate agent at an early point, maybe the neighbor, we have known company that works with neighborhood involvement. So we always go out and interview people, talking to them about what they want for their neighborhood. That's also a thing that's coming. So it's always trying to integrate all of these things. And then again, the architects are maybe the ones in this mix that has the sort of biggest overview. So in the end, we are sort of responsible, or people will hold us accountable for how it's going to look, even though there's so many people involved. So we have a really big responsibility, as we say. Yeah.
That was Yonny Klock in conversation with Monocle's Charlie Fillmore Court. The exhibition, Mad About Dugnad, Work Together, Build Better, is on at 80s Architecture Forum in Berlin until the 10th of March. And that's all the time we have on today's show. If you're keen for even more design-related listening, catch our five-minute midweek sister show, Monocle on Design Extra. That airs every Thursday. Today's show was produced by Charlie Fillmore Court and Maitley Evans, who also edited the show with Chris Ablakwa. I'm Nick Manise. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.